so much for being here. I'm Jane Wales, and I'm chairing the Poverty Alleviation Track. And boy, am I glad to see you all here. This is a room full of people who have made commitments for which we are deeply grateful and which will have great impact. And we're going to talk a little bit today about commitments that have been made and how they're going. Because what we're learning is that commitments are, it's a sort of an organic process. You make your commitment, you set your strategy, and then you learn along the way and make adaptations. And so we're going to hear about that. There's a lot we've learned, we know already about the poor. We know the poor are ingenious. We know the poor are entrepreneurial. We know that the poor are deeply inventive and adaptive themselves, of course, that they're industrious. But what we also know is that they're very good customers. They are people who are worthy in the sense that they are deserving, but worthy in the sense that they hold true to their promises. And so what we're going to talk about is our promise to the poor and talk about some specific promises that have been made going forward. What we're going to do is we're going to have our first three commitment reports be in the form of videos, very, very brief videos, and then we're going to invite three commitment makers up to the stage for a conversation among them about their commitments. And what we're and before we start those videos, though, we're going to invite Bob and Anibale of Citi to come and join us. As you know, Citi has been supporting the Poverty Track, and Citi also has made its own commitment in this area. So please welcome Bob.
Thank you, Jane. And to everyone here, Citi's delighted to have been supporting the Poverty Track at the Clinton Global Initiative for the last 3 years and this year as well. And we're particularly happy to be with so many colleagues here that we've worked with, not only on our own commitment, but on a whole range of work in microfinance, including the organizations that the three speakers who will follow represent. And we've talked a bit about our own progress, I guess, which is important as we kick it off. In 2006, Citi made a commitment of $5.5 million to launch the Citi Micro Entrepreneurship Awards. And those were launched in 24 countries, and it reached 2 million individuals worldwide, bringing financial tools necessary to improve the lives and global financial information around financial education, a key tool. When we made the goal, the commitment was simple. It was to bring financial education, financial literacy to many of the people who we hoped financial services would reach through some of the organizations that will be speaking today and some of you in the room. Since that time, we've more than exceeded our own expectations and our goals. In 2006, the awards reached out to over 1,300 microfinance institutions. They generated nearly 5,000 nominations, and they honored 365 micro-entrepreneurs. These are done in their own countries and local juries and committees and bring an enormous visibility, I think, overall to microfinance in the countries where they're held. Going forward, in 2007, we reached 26 countries, 7,000 institutions, 6,000 nominations, with over 600 winners. We're delighted with our own commitment and our ability to live up to it and our partners helping us to exceed it. Finally, the results of the Global Financial Education Program have far exceeded the goals. Over the past 2 years, the program has trained over 4,400 trainers and provided outreach to over 11 million individuals, providing them with financial knowledge they need to take advantage of financial services that are being made available increasingly to them. There's anything but micro, what we're talking about in terms of our expectations and the scale of what we're trying to achieve. And the Citi Foundation, during this period, and if we look over the last 10 years, has brought over $60 million of grant funding to about 250 microfinance institutions and networks, many of which will be featured today, who really lead in that work. But maybe where I come in and my group's work was that we've tried to take microfinance beyond philanthropy and build on the remainder of what really needs to be delivered, which is the financial services that we do every day. in the 100 countries where we operate with the 300,000 people. And to that extent, we made a commitment in 2006, a $100 million financing commitment with OPIC, the Overseas Private Insurance Investment Corporation, OPIC, we all know in Washington. And we've more than exceeded that $100 million. We believe we will double that financing through an initiative which we started out with one set of expectations, and we found that we were able to take that much further than we thought. So our efforts have been around building not only our philanthropy to support microfinance, but how do we engage the businesses of Citi to bring financial services deeper? And in many cases, that's through partnering with leading microfinance institutions and networks, as we'll talk today. So thank you all. I'd like to thank President Clinton and the CGI team for continuing to be so supportive of this, of the poverty track, and enjoy your lunch.
Thank you, Bob. You're going to see another fellow from Citi pretty soon in our first working group session. A little less known than Bob and Nibale. It's the other Bob Rubin. So we look forward to hearing from the other Bob. You'll also be seeing Bob and Nibale on the stage with us this afternoon, because he's joined with the Aspen Institute and several extraordinary organizations in developing a new mega commitment. I'm now going to ask Lisa to join us on the stage. Lisa Pierkrum is going to announce the first video. She is COO and Vice President of RLJ Company. So please join us.
Good afternoon. The RLJ Companies is Bob Johnson's holding company, and we are here to report on our commitment in Liberia. 2 years ago, at the Clinton Global Initiative, Bob Johnson committed, along with a group of individuals, to invest in Liberia and to create a $30 million fund. We did that in partnership with OPIC, and you'll see today some of the results of that fund. To date, we have disbursed about $4 million in capital to entrepreneurs in Liberia. Businesses that capital has gone to are things ranging from a hotel, transportation company that will run buses in Monrovia in the capital of Liberia, a plant nursery, and a construction company, lots of different business areas. We were able, with the commitment of the government of Liberia, with the president, Madam Johnson Sirleaf, whom many of you know, to get this done very quickly. Within 6 months, we had a partner. We brought in CHF International, who run our fund, with a team of all Liberians who do the loan processing and run that office. And 6 months later, we disbursed the first $2 million. So about 8 months ago, Bob Johnson said yes when President Sirleaf then asked him to construct a hotel in Liberia. This is the first hotel construction, new construction in over 20 years in Liberia. And President Sirleaf would like that hotel for March, when the International Women's Conference will be held in Liberia. I was not in the room when that conversation took place. I spent about the next month convincing Bob that it's very difficult to build a hotel in a country with very little infrastructure, no plumbing, no roads, no water, and no treatment plant at this beachfront property. And then one day, Bob called me in and said, "Well, Lisa, now you have 11 months to build a hotel in Liberia. Better get cracking." So we are about 50% complete with the hotel. It's an 84-room villa resort-style hotel. We have employed 400 Liberians to build and construct the hotel, and they are gaining skills in millwork, plumbing, carpentry, and so forth. And our goal is to have them obviously employed then by other construction companies, two of which we've introduced to the country through this process. And just last week, we employed 150 Liberians to then operate the hotel. They will start their six-month training program October 1st. And March 1st, they'll be ready to open the hotel and welcome all of you all to visit Liberia. So, thank you.
And In September 2006, while attending the Clinton Global Initiative in New York, Robert L. Johnson heard President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf speak about Liberia and her strategy for rebuilding the nation after 14 years of civil war. Sirleaf said she wanted Liberia's private sector to be an engine of national reconstruction and called on American businesses to support the effort. Johnson was inspired by President Sirleaf's appeal and pledged to mobilize $30 million to help the government of Liberia revitalize its fractured economy and accelerate the process of economic development.
It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me, yeah.
In the months following this meeting at the Clinton Global Initiative, Johnson brought together the U.S. Overseas Private Investment Corporation, OPEC, and the non-governmental organization, CHF International, to create the $30 million RLJ Liberia Enterprise Development Fund. This first-of-its-kind fund makes loans ranging from $25,000 to $1 million to Liberian entrepreneurs working to build businesses and to create jobs within their communities. To date, the fund has made 24 loans totaling $3 million, and by the end of the year, the fund expects to make an additional 10 loans, bringing the total to about $5 million. Nearly 1,500 new jobs have been created. In March 2008, as part of the outgrowth of the RLJ Liberia Initiative, the fund broke ground on a $12 million oceanfront luxury hotel property, the RLJ Kendija Resort and Villas. For Johnson, the development of the Kendija Resort and Villas hotel project furthers his pledge to President Sirleaf to support her government and the people of Liberia. This compelling endeavor also reflects Bob Johnson's commitment to deepen the ties between the United States and Liberia and to encourage African Americans to be at the forefront of this effort. Bob Johnson's engagement in Liberia is a genuine reflection of the Clinton Global Initiative's mission to be a catalyst for devising and implementing innovative solutions to some of the world's most pressing challenges, especially poverty alleviation.
Thank you so much. The second video is a good friend, Jordan Castellauer, Vision Spring. As you know, Vision Spring is what brought us from our CVS pharmacy glasses to glasses you could buy, reading glasses you could buy at Nordstrom's that looked slightly better. And as a he has taken the concept of a micro franchise, and his commitment was to scale up his micro franchise to provide glasses and other eye care products throughout the developing world. As a result, 300,000 people will receive new glasses and new other eye care products, and 3,000 people will launch their own micro franchises. So let's see a quick film about that.
We saw a classic market failure, and one that we felt that we could help to solve.
India is a country that will be incredibly significant to all of us going forward. And if you do it right here, I think you get it right in many other places as well.
In rural India, people insist on seeing a doctor for their everyday health needs. So it was critical that we establish credibility with the local population so that they would believe that a local member of their community could be qualified to sell affordable reading glasses.
I think there's a professionalization that the Skoja Foundation has brought to this process, right down to the representative themselves and the vision entrepreneur. There's an element that they're coming in to see a pro who knows what they're doing, who's given real advice, and then selling them a product that actually makes a big difference.
Because our vision entrepreneurs live in the community that they serve, they're able to prescribe the right product to the consumers according to their needs.
We realize that we're a small organization and one that can't take care of 700 million people on our own.
We needed to create relationships with organizations that had a history of working with the villages in India that we wanted to work in.
Our goal is to empower other organizations to adapt our model to distribute reading glasses. We've condensed everything that a vision entrepreneur needs to start their own business into a backpack. We look for organizations that have a mission to help those in need and the local distribution networks to serve them. We're working with consumer products groups, healthcare organizations, internet service providers. We're making reading glasses as easy to purchase as laundry detergent in small towns and villages across India.
What we've created is universal. It can be applied anywhere in the world, any continent, any country. It enables people to start small businesses that makes their community a better place.
Now, I want to know how many of you picked up your Tom's shoes when you checked in? How many of you have been smart enough to be wearing your Tom's shoes? You'll figure out by tomorrow how sore your feet are if you're not. So the reason I'm mentioning the shoes I appreciate so much is that the third video is of Blake McCoskey, who's the founder and chief shoe giver of Tom's Shoes. His commitment was to provide 50,000 children in South Africa with new shoes and to provide 25,000 people in Ethiopia with new shoes. Tom's gives away a pair of shoes for every new pair it sells. So know that the pair you're wearing means that someone else in the developing world has got a pair, him or herself. Let me also note, Blake's in the room, so give us a hello.
People laughed at Blake when his idea was to start a shoe company basically where he gave away shoes for every pair that was sold. People laughed and said that was ridiculous. It's more about putting other people ahead of you.
Her oldest daughter is 26 and her youngest baby is 2 years old. She has on occasions bought shoes, but for the most they didn't have. Not for all of them.
And you have Tom's itis. Every time you see a child, you want to give them a pair of shoes.
People want to be a part of something that is good.
This is what the shoe drop is all about.
You may have never been with shoes on your feet.
He had one pair of new shoes in his life, and it's his second new pair of shoes.
This is the greatest thing ever.
Look what's happened in the last 6 months. We just gave away 8,000 pairs of shoes. Anybody who's starting a small company, everybody who has an idea, incorporate giving in what you do.
The great thing about CGI is it doesn't matter what your religious beliefs are, your politics, how much money is in your pocket. It's a group of people who come together with one common goal, and that's to make the world a better place. One of the coolest things I found about CGI is the accountability, and I think what I would call the positive peer pressure that you have when you make a commitment. Last year, we gave away 50,000 pairs of shoes. That was our commitment, and we met it. This year, we're having a commitment of 200,000 pairs of shoes to children around the world who desperately need them. And it excites me the fact that I'm going to be here and tell everyone that that's what we're going to do. And a year from now, people are going to want to know, did they make their commitment?
I'm going to invite Chris Crane, Maria Otero, Elizabeth Littlefield to come take the stage with me. Just a quick by way of background for those of you who don't know Chris. He's the one that's a guy. He's CEO of Opportunity International, and since he joined Opportunity in 2002, its revenues have grown by 30%, the number of entrepreneurs of you've supported have grown by the same, a similar amount. Our second panelist will be Elizabeth Littlefield. Elizabeth is head of CGAP, that you all know, the consultative group to assist the poor. This is one of these rare moments when somebody actually says out the full name. It's a global microfinance resource center, and its five-year commitment was to combine technology leaders and commercial banks to develop the technology platform needed, the infrastructure needed to reach the unbanked. And then coming up the rear here is Maria Otero. And Maria, as you all know, heads up Acción, Acción International. It's a global leader in microfinance. Its partners serve 3.5 million poor entrepreneurs, 65% of whom are women. We'll talk a little bit about its new commitment as well as its old, its ongoing commitment. Chris, I'm going to start with you and start with your ongoing commitment. You were seeking to scale up to $500 million in the field. Tell me how it's going, what you've learned in the process.
Good, Jane. Thank you. I'll start with an analogy. I was recently in Rwanda visiting a group of our clients. At the end of the meeting, as is the custom there, they gave a present to both me and our bank CEO. Beautifully wrapped, I opened the present. Mine was a wonderful bunch of bananas, which was great. I was starving, so we passed those around and ate them. Our bank CEO received what in Rwanda is a highly esteemed present. As he opened his box, a live rooster came out, complete with spurs, and that rooster was not happy for having been in that box. Well, Clinton Global Initiative is great at encouraging all of us to come up with new big visions and set big, hairy, audacious goals. And so, like the box where the rooster was in, you never quite know what's in there and what's going to come out, but you definitely know there are going to be surprises. So having said that, we did set two primary components of our goal 2 years ago in 2006. And we partnered with philanthropist John and Jackie Weberg, who gave us a $50 million grant to help bring 50 million people into financial services who previously were excluded from financial services, such as loans, savings, and insurance. We also sought to mobilize $500 million within 5 years. I'm pleased to say that at the end of 2007 and now already in 2008, we're about 12% ahead of the trajectory that we set to be able to help that 50 million people come into the financial services, so we're ahead of projection there. And perhaps the old adage regarding our second goal, the old adage of you often overestimate what you can do in 1 year but underestimate what you can do in 5 years. Regarding mobilizing the $500 million in grants and savings deposits and in capital markets borrowings, we have already exceeded that. We've actually mobilized $600 million in the form of $140 million in grants, $150 million in debt from the capital markets. And the big surprise, Jane, was $300 million in client savings as we opened and expanded our trans-African chain of microfinance banks for the poor. We were overwhelmed, and it's something Elizabeth has been saying for years, that there's all this hidden capital that the poor will put that into banks when you open up banks that specifically serve poor people.
Now, Opportunity in the process has merged with several other organizations. Are we starting, does this portend more consolidation in the field?
I think it does portend more consolidation. There are three significant trends that are occurring. First, technology. Those who are larger can invest in technology. Secondly, is access to capital. Those who are banks as opposed to an NGO, they can take in client savings. They can access the capital markets. So they're going to have the funds to scale up much more rapidly. And thirdly, I had dinner last night at the Poverty Alleviation Track, which Jane hosted. And I was speaking with Bob Anibili of Citibank, with Bob Kristen of Gates Foundation and Dr. James Bwangi, who's just there, of Equity Bank, CEO of Equity Bank in Kenya. And we were saying how expensive it is to move cash around, just the physical paper notes of cash. There's a tremendous percentage of the cost of doing business. And those who have the technology and those who have banks, those who have really scaled up, are going to be able to digitize many of those transactions. Such at Opportunity, we're using smart cards. We're using mobile banks with smart cards going out and ATMs to digitize that. So I think there's going to be more consolidation. We've acquired 5 microfinance organizations in the last 2 years. Those organizations see that they just can't provide as good a suite of services to the poor if they're not a bank, and so they're looking for bank partners to merge into.
Elizabeth's going to talk a little more about mobile banking when we get to her and about the leveraging of technology. But I wanted to just turn for a moment to your 2008 commitment, which is focused on the food crisis. And I wanted to get a sense of the scale of the problem and the set of solutions that you envision.
Yes, thank you, Jane. The Economist magazine says that since 2005, in the last 3 years, real food prices have increased 75% in developing countries. So you can imagine if a very high percentage of your budget, sometimes 40%, was going to food before that increase. Now these people are extremely squeezed. There have been food riots and lots of social unrest in 3 countries. So we have partnered with the John Deere Foundation to expand our agricultural services to farmers in 5 countries. We started in 2006 with a pilot program to validate the model. We found that by making loans to farmers, that farmers have basically quadrupled their output. What we're providing is better seeds, better fertilizer, and then we'll have, say, a group of 50 farmers in an area will hire a tractor to come in and plow all of the farms just at one time, so they have economies of scale. We're seeing that with this $5.75 million commitment, as we use leverage of savings and capital markets, it will result in $30 million being made available to farmers, and it will provide 18,000 jobs to farmers as we go forward.
Thank you so much. We will be having a panel on the whole question of food security and poverty, and so we'll be able to explore this even further. Elizabeth, your goal in your ongoing commitment was to unlock really the potential of mobile banking. Can you tell us a little bit about what you have learned in the process?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Jane. Yes, we did set out in 2005 with the CGI commitment to work with telecom operators, mobile operators, and banks to try to develop mobile banking that would actually work for poor people in a number of countries. And, you know, why is that? Well, because we all know how important access to finance is to boost, you know, livelihoods of poor people. And, in fact, the real Achilles heel all along has not been risk. It's been transaction costs, the cost of making tiny little transactions in remote areas to poor people, the tiny transactions that they need. So we figured that, you know, if you can use cell phones or technology to reduce the cost, which it does, by, you know, 5, 10, 50-fold by using cell phones, then we could actually reach the most remote and poor people that we couldn't reach with the normal bricks and mortar branches. Now, actually, it's usually at this time when I see some furrowed brows in the room thinking, how does the cash come out of the cell phone? And it doesn't come out of the cell phone. We can get into that later, maybe in the next panel. But basically, the cell phone acts as a means of sending a message and identifying the sender, but it needs to be used in conjunction with a cash point, usually a shop or a prepaid airtime reseller of some kind that already exists in poor people's neighborhood where bank branches don't. So that's the idea. And so we launched this in 2005, and then very generously co-funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and working with partners like DFID and actually with Opportunity and Acción and others, we're now 4 years in and pretty close to achieving our targets, actually exceeding our targets and exceeding our hopes as well. We've pretty much, we've funded and advised 11 now pilot experiments in different countries. In fact, James Bwangi being an Equity Bank being one of them, to really work with telcos and banks and figuring out how you could do this. We've conducted policy diagnostics with governments in another 10 countries to figure out what is the regulatory framework that needs to be constructed to allow this. Because, you know, regulatory frameworks around the world were not constructed with a view towards this convergence of banking systems, telecommunication systems, and payment systems. They're all in silos now. So how do you go about figuring out how to construct that system while still protecting, you know, allowing access to be unleashed while still ensuring the safety of the system. And then we did quite a lot of research based on this work and published a series of white papers. And you asked about lessons learned, or were you going to ask about lessons learned?
No, go for lessons learned.
Sorry. Well, there's good news and the bad news, because there's been successes and there's also been some disappointments. The good news, first of all, is that it seems to work. We have over 20 telecom operators, mobile operators, that are experimenting today with new ways to reach poorer people and the unbanked using mobile banking. You know, they're doing so in part because they want to find ways to make their channels more profitable and also to make the clients stickier, if you will. Banks actually aren't getting involved as much as we thought, which is a disappointment. We're finding demand is huge. In Kenya, M-Pesa, which is a subsidiary of Safaricom, it within 18 months had 3 million subscribers to its mobile banking service. This is in a country with only 2 million bank accounts. That's only in 18 months. So the demand is huge. Now, on the negative side, we've found some disappointments, as I said, and that has been that, frankly, most of the mobile banking that's happened in the world right now has really been about payments, moving money from one place to another. It's not been about savings at all. And savings, as we know, is one of the most important things, as Chris said, for poor households. We need to do a lot more work to figure out how to use technology to build safe places for poor people to save money outside the household. And lastly, another big disappointment, which gives rise to our next commitment, is that really it hasn't been about poor people. Most of the M-banking that's gone along, that we've seen so far, has been about providing more convenience or more access to existing customers or decongesting branches than it has been reaching new and poor customer bases. So that's been sort of what we found so far in this commitment.
So looking forward, how are you thinking about ensuring that we truly understand what the poor both need and want?
Well, we think that we understand the basics of what needs to be done, and therefore our new commitment, this one now, is that we think with the bases having been built, we can reach 25 million people in the next 4 years by tweaking the system in certain places, by working on better policy environments, by funding more experiments, and perhaps most importantly, by doing a lot more effort to understand what poor people really want and will use. You know, what kind of product design, what kind of processes are needed, what kind of interface on the cell phone will be useful to an uneducated or illiterate woman in a rural area. You know, I'm thinking of examples in Japan. There's a cell phone that's used for older people that has really big buttons that are lit. And I don't know if your parents have their address book in the cell phone. Mine don't. There's a little drawer that comes down with a piece of paper and a pencil where you write your names and numbers. So product designs like that kind of innovation is where we really need to put our effort to really understand, you know, what are poor people going to use, how can they use it, and how can it benefit their lives. So that's the kind of, we feel that the groundwork is laid and we can really, really take off now.
It's a real lesson on the importance of having the ultimate beneficiaries at the table when you're undertaking the design.
Exactly.
Maria, in your previous commitment was to set a goal to deliver microfinance to services to 15 million in India. And I wonder if you could give us a very quick update and also a sense of lessons learned.
Sure. First, I want to thank you for having myself, all of us here, to be able to present to you what we've been working on. It's really just a privilege to have an opportunity to share that. And I really appreciate being able to do that. One of the things that we did in our commitment in 2005 was to work in hands with, in partnership with another microfinance institution, Unitas, and I don't know if Unitas is here, there's Elizabeth, to work together in order to be able to reach 15 million clients in India. This effort of bringing two organizations to work together was in itself somewhat new, but it was very much based on the fact that we could complement each other in the work that we were doing. Acción could bring some levels of skills, Unitas could bring others, and we could really have a much stronger force and bring much more value to what we were doing. We started by setting up an office, a training center, really, in Bangalore in India, setting up our staff there, and then using the model that Unitas has used, which is to really find those entrepreneurial, hardworking, sort of visionary, but still small nonprofit microfinance efforts in the country, and give them resources, train them, provide what they need in order to help them really grow and reach large numbers of people faster than we normally do. So using that model, using Acción's knowledge in providing technical assistance, we've been working in that area since. What Acción did as well was try to incorporate new ways of making loans to people, especially in rural areas. In India, almost everyone that's working in microfinance has worked in the rural areas, of course, where the majority of the poor people are. But the slums of Mumbai, the areas where you find an enormous concentration of poor people crowded into small places with very few resources, is one area where access to financial services is also enormously needed. And so this is where we have been trying to work, and we have been also trying to partner with banks and with new players in the India context, where, like in everything else in India, microfinance is popping. So the outcome that we have so far is that the partners that have come together, I think through Unitas, there's probably over 12 partners, and Acción has brought some other ones to the table. We have about 3.5 million clients. The work in the urban areas has not gone as fast as we had expected. It has been more difficult to reach the clients. We are now and have incorporated all the many things that both Chris and Elizabeth have talked about, so that in order to be able to make the credit available to people from kiosks or from storefronts or from other ways rather than just having them go to a branch or to a place that will take them a long time to get to. So overall, I think we're moving in the direction of the 15 million. I think it's a very big undertaking. And what we are finding is that in this, and I think this is one of the lessons learned, is that in this early stage, there's two things that we hadn't really thought we would have to do as much, but as we have. One is we really are focusing on building local capacity to be able to simply deliver financial services. This is one area that is enormously difficult, and, you know, we can talk a great deal more about that. But it takes resources, and it's very important to be able to complete it. The second one is attracting capital to be able to grow these institutions. And that's not going to work only with donations. We've really had to be able to both put capital on the table ourselves as organizations and be able to leverage others that can make loans to the microfinance institutions, help them build their equity. Unitas has put in $5 million. Acción has put in $5 million. We've created equity funds that can attract other sources and that can also allow us to invest even beyond the microfinance institutions that we're working with. So we're seeing that in developing this in India, we really are trying to help create all the pieces that are going to allow us to build the industry, if you can call it that, in the country. And I think the outcome is going to be not just 50 million, and hopefully we will reach the 50 million, but really an infrastructure and a collaboration by the private sector, by ourselves, by other partners in really developing the capacity in a country that has such enormous need.
Now, I mentioned at the very beginning that commitments are really kind of sort of living, evolving. They're organic. You start with a very strict strategic plan, a set of benchmarks, et cetera. But along the way, you have learnings that force adaptations. Were you just describing those adaptations, or are there others that you had to make?
I've just described some of the way in which we had to spend our time and our resources in really accessing the capital that you need in order to be able to do this and creating the funds or the vehicle so that you can attract additional capital is enormously important. And that has become a very key piece. The other one is that we really sought to work more with banks to bring them more as players and as the deliverers of financial services. And they have shown some interest, and they have gotten involved. But I think, as Elizabeth said, they have fallen short as a model that we can use and that we can expand. And we are seeing that more and more we're going to have to really create microfinance banks that service and focus on the poor. So there are quite a number of variations.
I really invite everyone in this room, as they work through their commitments, to think about the fact that you are in the process of adding knowledge to a field. So as you adapt your own commitments, others can learn from those, from that requirement to adapt and from your agility. So thanks so much. Maria, I'm going to take you to your 2008 commitment, because this is an effort to ensure that there are clear ethical standards in the field. So I want to have a sense of, first, the nature of the problem, and second, the nature of the solution. Was there something to which you were reacting that made you choose to take this on?
The commitment that we have taken on this year is a commitment through our Center for Financial Inclusion, which is really a campaign for all of microfinance for client protection. The idea, just to describe it and then explain why, is to really unite, bring together everyone that is working in microfinance and really have them embrace a set of principles and a statement that have to do with the appropriate treatment that clients should receive from microfinance institutions. It's a little bit like the Hippocratic Oath that doctors take or the professional responsibility that lawyers take. We are looking to create a microbanker's oath that everyone will that is involved in providing financial services to the poor will not only understand but embrace and then have it be part of what they are doing. Why are we doing this? And we didn't make this up this week, as we saw that if there had been consumer protection in Wall Street, perhaps we wouldn't be having some of the meltdowns that we have now. We really created it because as microfinance is engaging more commercial players, more investors, private investors that are really seeing that commercial banking is the model that is being used in microfinance, and that certainly Opportunity International, Acción, CGAP, and many others have been moving forward, that it is very important as one moves forward with a model that is profit, that has a profit objective, that one also make it very clear that the social objective is enormously important. And that social objective has to be in partly established with the way in which the clients are treated. And that's, I think, one of the most important components of the commitment. The commitment really expects to reach at least half of the microfinance institutions that appear in the listing, which we call the mix in the field. There are 500-plus institutions in the mix. We'd like for at least half of those to be able to take on this this pledge and to apply it to their organizations. Just briefly, I just want to say, what are the core principles that this client protection effort takes on? There are just six that would seem very, very straightforward. One is avoid over-indebtedness. Lend to people what they can pay back. Don't exploit this part. I mean, as I say, this sounds so relevant to what we're hearing today. Second, transparency. Transparency in pricing, in terms and conditions, and fair pricing as that is done. Third, that collections not be abusive, or that in trying to collect a loan, one not engage in activities that are really unethical. Fourth, that the staff themselves really understand the high ethical principles that they themselves should carry out, the staff of every microfinance bank. Fifth, that clients know that there is a place where they can complain and where that they can address some of their grievances. And then sixth, we protect their privacy. Now, what is important about this initiative is that it is not just Acción doing it. We have built a coalition of founders, and among those coalition of founders are CGAP and Opportunity International. So this is really an effort among some of the organizations that are most out front to really take the lead. And CGAP will work more with the investors. Those that are investing in microfinance should be concerned about this and should be requesting this. And those of us that work on the ground, that work with the microfinance institutions, will be working with those institutions so that every loan officer, every middle manager, every branch manager has these core principles as part of the values and of the way in which they operate.
So, Maria, because our time is coming to a quick end, I just wanted to very quickly ask the two of you to just comment on what it takes to operationalize these core principles.
Well, we applaud Axion's leadership, especially Maria's leadership in this whole area. It is so important to have this these ethical standards in. We're trying to serve the poor. There are some that, especially as more and more institutions are coming into the field, some that have been in other fields before and now are coming into microfinance, that may not have perhaps the best interest of serving the poor at heart. So these two, we need to convey these right down to the all levels in our organizations, especially to loan officers, so they understand these. But Maria's coming up with some good concepts and models and templates to work with that we can do this. So thank you, Maria.
Great. Any closing comments, Elizabeth?
Yes, no. I mean, I think we, too, would heartily embrace the notion of consumer protection more broadly, but also transparency around the cost of services, an area that I think deserves particular attention and is being given it. You know, the microfinance field should be proud that it's spent three decades now focusing on financial transparency and financial performance. And we're proud to say there's now, 700 profitable microfinance institutions, over 1,000 that report all their data. Many of them are rated by credit rating agencies. But no one's ever looked on what their social performance is and whether or not they're treating their customers well. And there's been some confusion recently with the entry of banks, as Maria said, which is, are the banks and the consumer credit companies necessarily bad and the microfinance institutions necessarily good? Well, no. You know, you can have some of each. And so I think it's really about redefining the perimeter of our world of microfinance and having it rooted in the notion of having client benefit be front and center rather than shareholder benefit, frankly, or in tandem with shareholder benefit. And that's, to me, really what it's about, reshaping the perimeter of the field.
Thank you so much. I would love each of you to think about whether or not next year you would like to report like this on the progress of your commitment, bearing in mind that it's a learning experience for others and that this is an important thing that you have to give to the rest of CGI. Before I call this, though, to a close, we're going to have a little bit, Daniel, are we going to talk a little bit about the process we're going to follow over the next 3 days, and I'm going to say a word about the panels that are ahead. But I wanted to have Daniel Stone of America Speaks just give us a sense of the process. I'll then close with some of the substance, and then you'll join me in thanking this wonderful panel. But Daniel.
Thanks very much. I welcome you all to the Poverty Alleviation Working Sessions. As those of you who have been here in the past will know that the working sessions are at the core of much of what takes place at CGI. And frankly, it's one of the things that I think members find really most enjoyable and productive about their experience here. And one of the core features of the working sessions is the chance for each one of you to, first of all, hear wonderful comments and exploration of issues here from the stage by the panelists and the moderators, but then to have yourself be directly engaged in the conversations at your tables. So the way the sessions are going to work is they're 90-minute sessions, and we start out with the moderator and panelists on the stage, introduced by Jane, and then they'll spend about half an hour laying out the issues and exploring what some of the possibilities are for action on those issues. After half an hour, we'll give the moderator and panelists a break, and we will then come to the stage and pose to you at your tables a discussion question that we would like you to focus on for about half an hour. All of your tables will have a facilitator at them, and you'll see laptop computers show up on the tables, and they'll be taking your comments down during the conversation that are essential comments into the computers. And once they're in the computers, they'll be sent to the back of the room, where we have a group of folks that we call a theme team. These are very knowledgeable people about these issues of poverty alleviation who are also very quick synthesizers. And they're going to synthesize your comments as they come in during the course of the table group conversation. After about a 30-minute table group conversation, we'll invite the moderator and panelists back to the stage, and we'll give them a chance to answer some questions that you may have identified earlier that you would like them to address, and we'll explain how that works later on. Then after a few minutes of that, Jane will come back to the stage and she will review with you what some of the major themes were that came out of your table group discussions, as well as some major kind of uniquely interesting, provocative, challenging ideas that also came up through the table group conversations. So you get a sense of not only what happened at your table, but what were some of the themes that were discussed throughout the room. And then after Jane does that, then the moderator and panelists will take a few minutes to comment on those themes and gems and make some closing comments. And finally, we'll close the session by having Jane come back on the stage and honoring some more commitments that have been made relative to that topic. So I want to encourage all of you to engage in these conversations. They can be really fun conversations. They are real opportunities to learn and share learnings and also make new connections. And I also want to encourage you, as you can, to come in and sit at tables with folks you don't know. I know in these kinds of settings it's often so tempting to come in and sit with the folks you already know, but this is really a chance to expand your sense of network and folks you meet here at CGI. So that's how it's going to work.
Thanks so much, Daniel. And let me just give you just sort of a quick reminder, because a lot of this panel helped prepare you for the first working group session, which will be on financial services for the poor. And again, you will see throughout that what we're going to try to do is take a look at how we move beyond microfinance that has been such a success story, to think about ways that the poor can build assets and ways that the poor can, in fact, protect their assets, as Chris suggested, through insurance and other forms. So that will be our first panel, and that's where the other Bob will from Citi will be. The next panel, I think I've got this in order, but Esther will tell me if I don't. But I think it'll be on building livelihoods in post-conflict situations. And there, you all got a chance to hear President Johnson Sirleaf this morning. Here's a situation where, President Sirleaf has often said, Liberia is not a poor country. It's a country that's been governed poorly. And here we have this unique situation, or wonderful situation, in which in a post-conflict situation, you are facing one of the best governments with one of the best sets of policies you could imagine. But will it succeed? Is that sufficient? Does it have the resources? Does it have the foreign direct investment that it needs? Does it have the philanthropic interventions that it needs? How do we prevent it from tipping, I'm just using Liberia as an example, but countries in that position from tipping back into conflict? And a fundamental part of the answer is building livelihoods, giving everyone a stake in their economy and in their country's future. The third panel will be on food security. Oh, I've done it in reverse. Well, you'll be able to see it in your reading notes, but we're going to take a look at the issue of food security and there, and its interplay with poverty. And there we're thinking both of the short-term crisis to which Chris referred, which is both a humanitarian crisis and, as Haiti will tell you, a political crisis. And the real challenge for us is to think through what is the best way to address that crisis in a way that is consistent with dealing with the long-term problem of vastly increased demand for food as economic development occurs, and some insecurities that result from climate change. So how do you build sustainable agriculture, and how do you ensure that your two strategies are well aligned? And then the fourth and final panel will be on information and poverty, this is the M-Banking panel, in which we will talk a good deal about the tremendous opportunity that cell phones provides. So what I ask of all of you, and we have a shared panel with the climate change track on the interplay between climate change and poverty. And here, of course, we will move beyond a conversation about climate change mitigation to the whole question of adaptation. And what is the responsibility of the rich world to the poor? What is the, or put differently, what is the responsibility of those carbon emitters to those who are most immediately feeling the impacts of climate change? So I invite you to deeply engage in these conversations, but to recognize, as you have in all previous CGI sessions, that while the panel is there to kind of get you going, what's really interesting is the person sitting next to you. And because everybody in this room has expertise that they're bringing to bear, and everyone in this room has made a commitment from which we can all learn and from which they will learn. So I want to thank you all for starting us out this morning. I want to thank Maria and Elizabeth and Chris, because we're talking about three of the true leaders in this field, and thank you for sharing both your successes and your surprises with us today. Thanks so much.